That was really nice. Thank you. Thank you for saying that I'm smart. That's really nice. I don't know if I'm smart. I'm smart enough to realize that it is 8:56, and that we are running late, and that you are all scheduled for the sugar low after your chocolate pudding in approximately 6 minutes. So I think I'm gonna do something smart. I think I'm gonna start in the middle. No, you want Act One? I can actually run through Act One really quickly. It's a bunch of thank yous. Thank you. There's a joke about Sarah Palin. It's not that good a joke. Now I can't go back. All right. Okay, I'll start with Act One. But if you feel like you have to take a bathroom break or just leave or fall asleep, just do it. So thanks to Mass Humanities. Mass Humanities are my favorite humaniteers in the world. And this was a great day. And thanks to all of my fellow participants and moderators and everybody who made this happen. I am the host of a cable news TV show. I started my show September 8th, 2008, which was the Monday immediately following the second of the two political conventions last year, right after the Republican convention. So as long as I have been a cable news host, lo these 14 months, as best as I can tell, the job description for cable news host is someone who talks about Sarah Palin as much as possible. You know, people ask me, you know, like, is there censorship? Is there stuff you can't talk about? I know NBC is owned by GE. No, the only directive is talk about Sarah Palin a lot, because every time we do, there go the ratings. And, you know, I will say, I don't resist. It is fun to talk about Sarah Palin. I wish her a long, long, verbose public life. So that my new profession will continue to have a reason to exist. But as fun as it is to talk about Governor Palin and all of the other figures who function as cartoon heroes and villains and antagonists and provocateurs and spokesmodels and watchdogs and attack dogs, you know, the universe as portrayed by cable news, the really fun part is trying to figure out how to talk to an audience that is mostly expecting cable news about problems that are not easy cable news fodder. Because most of what we do is a sort of modern-day Punch and Judy show, the challenge, and I think it is the fun part, is to figure out how to engage an audience that's expecting today's edition of Palin v. World instead on issues that really don't have easy heroes and villains. And the challenge in doing this kind of work and still being a good citizen and being responsible about this opportunity and about the real challenges that face us as a country is to still get people to watch, to get a lot of people to watch, to get as many people to watch as possible, even when what you're talking about doesn't have good heroes and villains. And I'm telling you, heroes and villains, good guys and bad guys, is the way to get ratings. But sometimes that's not the most important thing to talk about. And so, for example, I have on my show done two very long monologues on cable news in primetime about the F-22 Raptor fighter jet. How do you make that interesting to a cable news audience? Well, in the first instance, the first time we decided to do one, it was when the Senate voted to kill the F-22, and we captioned our segment about that. This is a 10-minute segment on primetime cable news about defense procurement policy, and we decided to caption it JetBlue, B-L-E-W, thinking that, you know, maybe people aren't all that interested in how we buy jets, but at least they might be interested to tune in to see about what blue. In that first F-22 segment, I also called this particular fighter jet the vestigial third nipple of the U.S. defense budget. And again, maybe you don't care about jet fighters and the defense budget, but you might be enticed to stay simply by the phrase vestigial third nipple. The second time that we did a monologue on the F-22, I did not use either of those tricks. And while you might be grateful to hear that, I can tell you that the ratings for the JetBlue vestigial third nipple segment were way better than they were for the segment that did not have those references. To the extent, though, that we are willing to be performative and to use funny words and provocative language and puns and analogy and humor and drama to convey what it is that America is doing on defense, I think we ought to. even though it sometimes fails. I think we ought to try. If there's a way to engage not a specialist audience or a military audience, but a mass audience about the import and strategy and moral implications of multi-billion dollar defense budget decisions, I think we ought to do it. I think it's a good thing to do for the country, but it is hard to do. As much as we demagogue the issue of national security and use terrorism as bait for our politics, overall questions about the strength and the purpose and the use and proper care and feeding of America's military is remarkably insulated from American politics. And I'm not talking about, you know, whether or not people or parties in the news are people who support the troops. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about whether or not we make decisions about the military through an overt, recognizable political process. So, you know, how much is the defense budget subject to competition with the nation's other budget priorities? Why is spending for ongoing wars handled through emergency supplemental appropriations, as if we had no idea it was coming? It was a policy that was started under the previous administration and carried over into this one, although President Obama now says he will put an end to it. What was the political process that led to our policy of shooting drone-fired missiles at extremists who threaten the government of Pakistan, at the government of Pakistan's request? What was the political decision that led to the U.S. embassy in Kabul being guarded by DynCorp? Two U.S. soldiers were killed by a landmine in Jolo at the end of September. When was the political debate, and what was the political debate about us deploying hundreds of American troops in the southern Philippines? What are they there for? And if they are risking their lives for an American national security interest there, are the American people in whose name they are fighting and risking their lives aware of what that national security interest is in the southern Philippines, where our troops are sometimes dying? And I don't mean to say that I should have a direct vote on these things. I host a cable news TV show. What do I know about the intricacies of Filipino extremism or what it takes to guard an embassy, right? But what I at least want to throw out there is an idea about how connected we are as Americans to what our military is and does. Have we settled into a pattern where we have parallel tracks for military and political matters in our country that don't intersect? Not because civilian control of the military has broken down, I don't think it has, but because the defense industry and the foreign policy establishment and the military itself have become a self-perpetuating, internally consistent, isolated, resilient policy universe, which is now expected to provide Washington not only the policy options, but the means of implementing those policy options on defense issues, and the rest of us are bystanders. Because of the insularity of that policy universe, I think that the range of options that are considered is more limited than it ought to be, and I believe it is more often it is often unduly tilted toward interventionism. I think because we talk about our politics as if it's something that we hate, but I think that our politics, as partisan and unpleasant and dysfunctional as they are, serve a purpose in connecting us to the decisions that our policymakers make. And I think because there isn't a more rollicking, populist, engaged debate in this country about how to employ military force, I think that we have drifted over the past couple of generations into a pattern of interventionism and over-reliance on the military that I don't think that we planned on and I don't think we want. One of the things that's prevented a backlash to that over time is that we are somewhat insulated from the consequences of our military actions. And it's a couple points about that insulation that I'd like to advance. This is what life during wartime feels like now, with the caveat that high-minded symposia on the citizen and the soldier are the exception and not the rule in terms of our self-consciousness about being a nation at war now. But we are in year 9 and year 7 of two hot, brutal wars. And to most of us, that is an abstract truth. It's frequently asserted that that's because of the absence of a draft. Our military is an all-volunteer force, a professional fighting force that is viewed as capable of taking up the risks of combat on the nation's behalf. And because of that, we don't necessarily think of ourselves as going to war. We don't think of ourselves as voting to go to war. We think about ourselves voting to send our troops into war. And that attitude toward them, that they are a standing force that's there to be used, after all, they signed up, it's evident bluntly sometimes in the language of our debates about war. In February 2007, during a debate about Iraq, Congressman Phil Gingrey of Georgia, one of my favorites, argued against a reduction in U.S. troop levels by saying, quoting, on the floor of the House, "What indeed are we going to save our troops for? Working the rope lines at 4th of July parades? Helping senior citizens cross the street?" And the rhetorical answer to his rhetorical question, of course, is that we should not save the troops for any such peaceable nonsense. They're there to be used in combat. The observation that there is a connection between having an all-volunteer fighting force and our national attitude about going to war is not only not an original observation, it's in part what drove the reorganization of the Army after Vietnam, so it would be operationally dependent on the reserves. And this is one of those things that sounds bureaucratic and technical, but it actually has really simple, deep implications for our country. And I promise it's quick. If you have never heard of the Abrams Doctrine before, hear this, but hear it with a grain of salt, because not everybody agrees on how this was intended or how it worked out. There are libraries full of fights about this, but here is how I see it. Creighton Abrams' reorganization of the Army made it so that the reserves were responsible for functions without which we could not wage a major military campaign. In other words, you couldn't go to war without the reserves. Abrams was U.S. commander in Vietnam from 68 to 72, while troop strength there went from over 500,000 to 1/17 of that number. Then he was Army Chief of Staff from 1972 until he died in 1974. And in that time frame, with the wind down of the Vietnam War as context, the idea was, it seems to me, and the people fight about this, it seems to me the idea was to make it harder to go to war, or at least harder to go to war without having the support of the American people for that war. When the draft was ended, America returned to an all-volunteer force, we would find ourselves designed out of the opportunity to wage war in a way that was dislocated from the everyday experience of American families. So by making the capability of the military dependent, of the Army specifically, dependent on the reserves, policymakers could wage wars only that had enough support from the American people to withstand this wrenching experience of pulling reservists and guardsmen out of civilian life in order to go fight somewhere else. If one of the things that was made clear by Vietnam was the risk to the country and to the military of being at war without public support, this was an effort made to separate the American military from the risk of going to war without that support by creating a high threshold of public acceptance that you would need to get before you could actually mobilize a military effort ever. Smart, right? It didn't work. We are at war in Afghanistan right now with only 39% of Americans in favor of us being there. And the distinction between reserve forces and active duty forces is lost on most civilians because they all seem to be called up now for so often, for so long, so many times. So the effort to use the structure of the military as sort of designed insulation against going to war without public support overestimated the responsiveness of our defense policymakers to the public's wishes. It overestimated the capacity of our representative system of government to prevent us from engaging in wars that the country didn't support or that the country ought not support. It overestimated the role of Congress in deciding when and whether and how we wage war and how we end war. It's my view that Congress, over time, has abrogated its responsibilities under the Constitution of being the branch of government responsible for declaring war. And you can blame presidents for taking it, but I blame Congress for giving it. These are responsibilities that were purposely given to Congress and not to the executive by the founding fathers in order to protect our country from the kingly inclinations toward war that the colonists found so vile in the first place. I think we have also underestimated the extent to which further changes in our defense structure made the general public's experience of war less acute. And therefore lessened strong public feelings about the war. Consider the effect of our reliance on contractors. In 1992, a defense secretary who's now lost to the obscurity of history, a guy named Dick Cheney, asked the company Brown & Root, which had been out of military contracting for a while, to think about getting back in a big way. And he commissioned Brown and Root to study how a private contractor might profitably feed, house, and support U.S. troops in 13 locations around the world. It was a $3.9 million contract. And at the end of that study period, lo and behold, Dick Cheney decided that he was the best candidate for vice president. Well, different, but same idea, right? no wonder they got along so well. At the end of Brown and Root's $3.9 million study period, Brown and Root concluded that it would do a great job for the Pentagon. And so the Pentagon signed him up to what seemed at the time to be a massive logistics contract, feeding and transporting and housing troops. And it was this sweet deal in which the government reimbursed them for all expenses plus gave them a guaranteed minimum profit. That was in the early 90s. They played a role in Somalia, Haiti, big role in Bosnia, and then jackpot Iraq. $16 billion, billion dollars in contracts. And the unassailable test of your seriousness, we have always been at war with East Asia, axiomatic, universally held, beltway truism of a belief that the American military is incapable now of feeding itself. That we are incapable of going to war, of performing any major military action without private for-profit contractors doing the laundry and driving the trucks and feeding the troops and protecting the embassy and motorcading the officials and interrogating the prisoners. We're really not capable of doing that ourselves? Didn't we used to do that stuff ourselves? It is a great business coup to have convinced the people with the deepest pockets in the whole world, America's military budget, that you may be expensive, but you are indispensable. These people cannot feed themselves. And so we have contractors. And what that means for our mortal souls is that our ability to use military force anywhere in the world is personnel elastic, in a way that is insulated from the political consequences of calling up and sending American troops, which is frankly something we still feel pretty acutely. If you want 250,000 pairs of boots on the ground in Iraq while waging another hot war elsewhere, but you don't have the political capital to convince the American people of the massive sacrifice needed to do that with troops, then, you know, just send the troops you can justify and hire the rest privately. Open checkbook, swivel wrist, moral problem solved. To the extent that America's worry for our troops, our tears over their deaths, our checks on policymakers' ability to put them at risk needlessly, farming out the work to contractors helps with that. Although contractors bolster American troop strength, they do so in a way that is somewhat politically risk-free, at least to us. The American public doesn't nationally lament contractor deaths the way that we do the deaths of our soldiers, in part because we don't even necessarily know when they happen. Companies are under no obligation to tell us when their employees are killed on the job. It's also in part because we lament the deaths of Americans over and above the deaths of people who are not Americans, for better or for worse. And we often do not have any reason to believe that American contracting firms are hiring actual Americans to do this risky work. And more, contractors are politically risk-free of way of using a military force, also because we don't even necessarily think of these companies' actions as American actions. We don't identify our national purpose with them, even if the U.S. government is paying them and directing their actions through contracts. To the extent that our warfighting capability is dependent on the capability of these companies, when we don't identify nationally with these companies, who owns Triple Canopy? Is that America? I mean, anybody? DynCorp? Do we think of that as America? To the extent that we don't identify nationally with these companies and our warfighting capabilities is dependent on them, we are nationally disassociated and disidentified with what it takes for us to fight our nation's wars. And there's a lot of moral risk there. Consider also drone warfare. It's one of the things we had a lot of interesting discussions about today. And to a certain extent, there's nothing novel about separating the threat to the soldier from the projection of force. I mean, as long as we've had a catapult, we've had people far away from the danger that they cause. But something about drone warfare has gotten under our skin in terms of our moral relationship to it. In Iraq and Afghanistan, and Lord knows where else, pilotless drone vehicles are operated by U.S. military personnel, both for surveillance and to fire missiles. In Pakistan, it's not the military. It's our CIA. And it's supposedly a covert program, but it's not exactly a secret. The Air Force fleet of drones is supposedly nearly 200. The CIA will not say how many they have. But this is one of the ways we kill people now. We kill them from the air, but without pilots. Peter Singer, whose Wired for War book documents the rise of robotics in combat, told Jane Mayer at The New Yorker for her excellent recent article on drones that drone warfare is seductive to policymakers because it creates the perception that war can be costless. I thought about that when Hillary Clinton went to Pakistan recently. And she was questioned again and again and again by Pakistani students and journalists about the drone strikes, about civilians killed, about the legality of the attacks. And Secretary Clinton wouldn't answer because the program is covert, after all. Officially, it's not happening. But for an American public insulated from that undeclared war we don't admit, and isolated from those casualties and that damage, and even from the emotional and moral connection to the risk of our own pilots that we have when we engage in bombing raids with pilots, that visit to Pakistan and the questions she got asked, it was like a beam of light in a pinhole camera showing the world outside this insulated box we live in, where our actions that we otherwise barely notice we were doing have not only the impact of violence, but they have massive political importance too. Obama administration officials acknowledge that one place in the world immune from the recent rise in pro-American sentiment, one place where the view of America has gotten worse in recent months is Pakistan, home to Al-Qaeda and AQ Khan and to our secret drone war that officially doesn't exist. Consider also the fact that it's the CIA and private contractors who are waging that drone war. The CIA has always used force, right? Infamously. But it's now become an almost acknowledged fifth branch of the military, with troops and its own air force and until recently even its own jails. All secret, all without a recognizable chain of command or recognizable rules of behavior or engagement. The CIA has become a full-fledged military force that wages war on America's behalf, and it has the handy feature of being able to do so in places where we are not supposed to be at war. Madison wrote to Jefferson in 1798, "The Constitution supposes what the history of all governments demonstrates, that the executive is the branch most interested in war and most prone to it. It is accordingly with studied care vested the question of war in the legislature." The legislature, of course, not only a deliberative body, but a representative body, one forced by the structure of government to take into account what the public thinks, public clamor and concern about the costs of waging war. And over time, the public have become more insulated from the human and moral costs of going to war, with our soldiers, a minority professional class, physically and in some ways culturally set apart from civilian life, with reserves and guardsmen so frequently called up that civilians don't distinguish between regular and reserve forces, with contractors stretching the numbers of those we deploy, but without the political cost of us nationally identifying with the contractors the way we do with the troops, with ongoing years-long military campaigns disavowed by our leaders, conducted in secret by a U.S. agency that does not admit publicly to its actions, with technology that allows us to project force far beyond the human risk to any of our troops, leaving us only with green-tinged, high-resolution video shot from on high that makes even the video game images of Gulf War I look like hand-to-hand combat in contrast, insulated from the impact of our own wars, numb to the cost, have we now started to lose interest in what the benefit of our wars is? The benefits of war against which its costs must be weighed. Looking back at the F-22 in closing, without talking about nipples, here's a question. What I learned in public policy class about the F-22 back in the olden days when we were still fighting about the F-22 was that this plane was a perfect way to understand how weapon systems got built and created and funded and overfunded, and they became huge sops for money, even though we didn't necessarily need them. And I mean, the F-22, it is a great case study. It was built to be too big to fail. It was built, designed as a plane to be politically uncancelable parts made in more than 40 states. No politician would ever dare vote against it because they'd be voting against jobs in their own districts. It was brilliant, right? But it was eventually too cynically obvious to survive. It was the staple textbook example of exploiting the policy process in a way that didn't benefit the country. And so ultimately it was sort of a gimme and it got canceled. But it took decades of ridicule and tens of billions of dollars later, but it's finally dead. And look at what's happened to this canceled plane post-death. The zombie denouement to Gates and Obama actually killing the F-22 for our own military is that Congress would now please like us to give it to other countries. Well, of course, we'd like to sell it to other countries. It's in the interest of American jobs and American defense contractors, of course, to keep building them. And who cares about whether or not those American jobs that those American defense contractors ultimately serve America or some other country that's vaguely friendly to us for now that has good money to pay. And hey, if they ever want to use those F-22s against us someday, then bully for us. Maybe America will want to buy some more new planes then too. Have we created a machine that makes war independent of American strategy and America's advantage in the world? Those contractors that maintain and arm and launch and land those drones that we're using to shoot into Pakistan, someday, does someone else pay them to point those drones in a different direction? Those private contractors who guard Hamid Karzai right now, if there's a coup against Karzai, will it be led by other contractors paid by Karzai's enemies to take out his guards? We were responsible in the year 2000 for selling 40% of the arms in the world market. 6 years later, by 2006, we were up to 52%. And it's still rising. It used to be a rather exclusive club of countries that had stuff like laser-guided missiles. Now we will sell them to just about anyone. Between 2001 and 2004, American arms, cumulatively, we sold less than $1 billion to Argentina, Azerbaijan, Brazil, Georgia, India, Iraq, Morocco, and Pakistan combined. Less than $1 billion in 4 years. In the 4 years after that, we sold them 16 times that amount. It's profitable. We're good at it. War is America's strong suit. What exactly is America better at in the world than war? So, as I said, I am a cable news host. I know I don't really know about any of this stuff, truth be told. But I can't help but think that when you look to where our defense policy has drifted, while we've left it to the experts, I can't help but think that if we hadn't left these decisions about these things just to the experts, we might not have drifted so far into a place where our actions feel so distant from our strategic interests. Our politics are frustrating and incomplete and partisan and stupid. I will admit, I'm part of the stupidity. But I think we need our politics more than we need these things to be made, these decisions about defense to be made without them. And that's my hypothesis. Thank you.